We're doing a mini conference at the Willow Creek Community Church in February, first week of February. And they've asked me to come out to try to prime the pump and get people interested and get things solidified at the government labs we'll be speaking at in February. We've been invited to go to both Argonne and Fermi labs. Those are two government labs with 10,000 scientists and engineers each. So it's well, I need to talk to the president of Fermi. He's not a Christian. He's an atheist, and he's a little bit nervous about my coming. So you might want to bathe that in some prayer, that door would remain open. And so I appreciate your prayers, too, for the TV and radio interviews I'll be doing there. I'm going to start off with a new discovery and see if you can figure this one out. And this was it's up on the web. It's going to be published in Physical Review Letters next week. And it comes out of Germany. It's some German physicists who have found iron 60 on the bottom of the Atlantic seafloor, about 15,000 feet deep. And the Pacific. They found it in the Pacific. And this iron 60 is a signature isotope, in that it's extremely rare in the Earth, but quite abundant in certain kinds of supernova. And so what this tells us is that a supernova must have exploded in the recent history of the Earth. Now, iron 60's got a half-life of 1.5 million years, and because it's got that kind of a half-life, they were able to come up with a date for when the supernova exploded, and it's 2.8 million years ago. But 2.8 million years ago is also that time in the history of the Earth when the African jungles retreated and were replaced by savanna. And so this caused the German physicists to conclude that this is what caused the big burst in human evolution. That we were kind of monkey-like in the trees earlier than 3 million years ago, and with the retreat of the jungles and the replacement with the grassland savannas, this forced the primates out of the jungles and into the savanna, where they had to walk upright and they became brainier, and this is how we human beings originated. Now, in saying all that, I would just ask you, what's wrong with this scenario? Now, to me, I looked at it and said there's obviously some fundamental reasons, but I thought, I have a pretty sharp Sunday school class. I'll bet you they'll be able to figure it out, because and give you more of the details. What he's saying is this supernova was so close that it burned off the ozone shield, allowed a lot more ultraviolet radiation to come in, and that was devastating for certain kinds of jungle plants, and so they were wiped out. And the planet became both hotter and drier as a result of this extra ultraviolet radiation. And then he ends the whole thing saying, this is a direct quote, "We may walk upright today because of a supernova explosion almost 3 million years ago." So again, what's wrong with this scenario? Okay, yeah. I mean, if this supernova was close enough to burn off the ozone shield, make the planet hotter and drier, and kill off all these jungle plants, and result in the savanna replacing the jungle, wouldn't that have wiped out the big apes and any bipedal primates that happened to be on the Earth at the time? That's excellent. The idea that this could have given a boost to, quote, the evolution of the bipedal primate line is really quite ridiculous when you consider the kind of damage this supernova eruption would do. And by the way, if a supernova were to erupt today relatively close to the Earth, it would do its greatest damage to species like us. We're going to go before the jungle plants go. So, we're loaded with lots of complex protein. We don't have much protection from the kind of radiation that comes from a supernova eruption. And therefore, we'll be the first to experience really significant damage from such an event. Now, the one scientific contribution that caught my attention in this article is these German physicists calculated how long the damaging effects from the supernova would last, and the answer is about 300,000 years. That's a long time to have the Earth bathed with killer cosmic rays that would be doing damage to the ozone shield. And again, the idea that we could have a species of bipedal primates survive such a supernova eruption just doesn't seem reasonable. Incidentally, from a statistical standpoint, just looking at the Milky Way galaxy in which we live and the frequency of supernova eruptions, we can expect an event like this about once every million years. And so that leaves a relatively narrow time window in which any kind of bipedal primate species can subsist. And this is something that Buzz and I are putting in our book, Who is Adam?, is the fact that when you look at the bipedal primate line, you see about 8 or 9 different species. But none of these species last for more than about a million years. And perhaps these supernova eruptions explain why we get these interruptions in the bipedal primate line. The other thing we note is, the longest lasting one would be the Homo erectus. They last a little bit longer than 1 million years, but when you look at the Homo erectus specimens that date to 1.8 million years ago and compare them with Homo erectus specimens that date to 600 million years ago, we can't see any difference. We see no evidence that they've changed over that period of time. And again, that's what our speciation model at Reasons to Believe It predicts, that when you're dealing with large body size species where they don't have quadrillions of individuals but only millions or billions of individuals, then the probability for evolutionary advance is zero. And indeed, that's what we see in these bipedal primates. We don't see any change. By the way, that's also true of the human species. Geneticists have now been able to dig up human beings that have been dead for 40,000 years. They've recovered their DNA and compared their DNA with modern human DNA, and we can't see any significant difference in the DNA of humans 40,000 years ago and the DNA of humans today. Same thing is true in Neanderthals. You pick up DNA from Neanderthals that lived 150,000 years ago and compare it with the most recently found Neanderthal DNA, which is 38,000 years ago, and we can't see any difference from 38,000 years ago to 150,000 years ago. But it's interesting that the supernova may indeed be at least a partial explanation for why we see so many bipedal primate species in the fossil line and why these species only last for about a million years at most. Yes. Oh, did I not talk about that last week? No, I wasn't here last week. Yeah, you're right.
Let me finish the question. Do they have enough biological material to make them accept the DNA one by second?
Yeah, it really is another species. And if you're not up to date on this, this is a specimen that was found on the island of Flores in Indonesia, which is pretty close to New Guinea. And they found this bipedal primate that was a female adult, a fairly old adult, and only 3 feet tall, and with a cranial capacity equivalent to that of a chimpanzee, namely about 380 cubic centimeters. And you say, well, how does that compare with ours? Well, most of the people here in the class have a brain capacity of about 1,500 cubic centimeters. So, and this would be the smallest brain capacity of any bipedal primate ever found. And yet it's being termed a revolution. In fact, Nature magazine wound up printing 9 articles on this find. And I think that's a record for any discovery that Nature has announced. And if you went to their website, in fact, I think it's still there, they have a big banner that says this is not a hoax, because it just seems so out of place. We discussed this in detail, Fuzz and I, in our Creation Update webcast last Tuesday. So you can go there, it's archived, and hear what we had to say about it and look up the papers. This is very disturbing for the evolutionary model, because you've got this very tiny-brained creature, yet clearly bipedal, showing up so late. I mean, the date was 18,000 years ago. So it's a date that goes well into the human era. On the other hand, there is no evidence that this Homo floresus had any contact with human beings or any contact with the Neanderthals. No evidence at all. Now, you're right in the sense that this is recent enough that there's a possibility that scientists might be able to recover mitochondrial DNA or even Y chromosome DNA from other Homo floresus finds. The one thing that makes that a little bit problematic is that this is not your typical fossilized bipedal primate. The island of Flores is warm and humid, and so inside a cave what they found were soft bone materials. The bone of this woman had just turned to mush, and the researchers referred to it as the equivalent of mashed potatoes. In fact, what was really one of the more significant scientific achievements here is being able to recover this pile of mashed potato bones and then reconstruct what the skull would have really looked like. And they didn't recover much. They got most of the skull and fragments of one of the leg bones. And then when they found this fragment of the leg bone, the tibia, they did notice that it had features that were unlike any other bipedal primate or human. So they said, this just doesn't fit. It's, you know, because the speculation was maybe this is a dwarfed subspecies of Homo erectus. But I argued on our Creation Aid Update webcast that scientific claim can't be valid because this tibia is just so different from anything that you see in the Homo erectus span of morphology. It's really a way out. And by the way, there is no Homo erectus that short. Homo erectus comes in at about 1.5 meters in height. This woman's only 1 meter. But the claim in the scientific literature is that we can explain the 1 meter because this is a small, isolated island. By the way, it's not that small. It's probably a third the size of California, so it's not exactly a small island. But their claim is that the shortage of resources would have caused natural selection to force the different species on the island to a smaller size. And what supported that, in their opinion, was that they had found evidence for a pygmy elephant on the island of Flores. However, the thing that you notice with pygmies within a species is that their brain capacity does not shrink in proportion to the height. For example, there are pygmies in Africa that are barely more than 3 feet tall, 3.5 feet tall, and yet their brain capacity is equivalent to people that play on the NBA. Maybe that's not saying the best thing about NBA players. But the whole point is there's barely any difference in the brain capacity of a pygmy human and a human being of normal height. So, and yet what we see in this Flores specimen is a very small cranial capacity. To compare with Homo erectus, Homo erectus averaged in at about 800 cubic centimeters. And so this creature has less than half the brain capacity of Homo erectus. And so the bottom line, in the opinion of Fuzz and myself, is that this find is an incredible embarrassment to the evolutionary model for the origin of the bipedal primates and the human beings. I mean, you've got this species sticking out like a sore thumb. But you can go to our Creation Update webcast or website, reasons.org, and read all about it and hear all about it. But boy, it sure made the news. It got on television, radio, newspapers, and 9 articles in the British journal Nature. So, and they say they're going to have to change all the textbooks. Well, I'm hoping they change the textbooks to point out that the evolutionary model just isn't fitting the data. I'm not sure that'll get into textbooks, but that's kind of the bottom line. And by the way, when you pick up our new book, it won't be out for another year, but that's kind of the conclusion of the book, is that every bipedal primate species that's been discovered contradicts the evolutionary model, every single one. Neanderthal, Homo erectus, the Australopithecines, Homo flores, every one is a contradiction. Yes. There's a debate over whether Homo flores could make tools. They did find crude Homo erectus type tools in the vicinity. But given the cranial capacity, there is many scientists arguing that this species, Homo flores, was using tools in the same way a chimpanzee uses tools. In other words, strictly opportunistic. We do know that Homo erectus was on that island 1.5 million years ago. And the tools, by the way, they're just simple slate tools. They're tools that Homo erectus would have made by taking a big rock and smashing a little rock and getting flakes off the little rock and then using the flakes as a tool. Now, there's nothing more sophisticated than that that's been found in the vicinity of Homo flores. But there are many anthropologists who are saying that this was opportunistic. Just like a chimpanzee will steal a human tool and make use of it, likewise Homo floresus was stealing tools from previously existing Homo erectus individuals and taking advantage of those tools, rather than making the tools themselves. And I would tend to agree, given the limited cranial capacity, and by the way, they've not found anything on the hands yet, and so we don't know whether this species had the dexterity to even make those kinds of tools. So that's an open question. It's a big debate. But yeah, you're right. The researchers made a huge deal about the fact that they found tools, and therefore this creature was quite advanced in spite of its small brain capacity. But, I've seen chimpanzees running around in the wild, and, they'll steal anything they can get their hands on. And it may look like they're using the tools, but from what I can tell, it's usually they're playing with the tools. They'll grab a hammer, and they'll use a hammer to break windows rather than using the hammer to pound nails in. It's quite different. So I think that's the way God's made a lot of these primates. They just like to pick up stuff and play with it rather than actually use it the way we would use it. Yeah. How did the Iron 60 get to the bottom of the ocean? Okay, when a supernova explodes, it produces a lot of iron. And iron 60 is radioactive iron. I mean, normal iron is iron 56. So this is iron with three more neutrons in its nucleus. And so with the explosion of the supernova, there'd be this bursting out of a lot of dust. And the dust would be loaded with iron 60. And as that dust falls on the Earth, it will sink to the bottom of the ocean. It's heavy, so it will sink to the bottom of the ocean. What they found on the bottom of the Pacific was this layer of iron 60 dust. And the concentration of iron 60 was so high, they said the only possible explanation is a really close supernova eruption. Otherwise, you can't explain this quantity of iron 60. No, there'd also be iron 60 on the land. But given that it's now been there for 2.8 million years, it will be disturbed by the erosion forces on the land. Whereas the advantage of the ocean is the stuff falls to the bottom of the ocean, and there's not a lot of disturbance on the bottom of the ocean, at least in the place they looked. I mean, some places at the bottom of the ocean, you've got subducting plates, but they found a place without subducting plates, and the stuff there is basically in pristine form. But that would be virtually impossible to recover pristine iron 60 2.8 million years after the event on any continental landmass. The wind is going to disturb it. The rain is going to mess it up. But bottom of the ocean, no problem. And by the way, physicists have found iron 60 signatures of other supernova on the bottom of the ocean. They have found one that dates to about a million years ago, for example, a fairly big one that 2 million years ago. This is another one. But what caught the attention of the British journal Nature on this one in making their announcement is they found a whole lot of iron 60. And the quantity of iron 60 is so high, they said this would have made a dramatic change in the climate of the Earth, wiping out the jungles and creating this savanna in Africa. How close is close? They have no idea. As you read the paper, they really don't tell you how far away this thing is, and they're not even that sure on the date. Because on the bottom of the ocean floor, it's still difficult to figure out how much iron 60 the supernova would have deposited. If it was a really big supernova, you would get more deposit of iron 60 than if it's an ordinary one. So even the date is a little bit suspect. I would say, they always say about 2.8 million years ago. It could be 2.5, it could be 3.0. It's in that neighborhood. So the date isn't that accurate, and the distance to the supernova is hard to determine because we don't know how big the supernova was, and astronomers have not had the benefit of a nearby supernova explosion to actually determine the kind of damage you get from a nearby supernova eruption. Maybe it's a good thing. That would immediately put a stop to a whole astronomy research program, right? Well, actually, each generation of dinosaurs was wiped out by either asteroid or comet collisions, every single one. The Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous. But the one that the public is most aware of is the asteroid that wiped out the Cretaceous, the last of the dinosaurs. That was 65 million years ago, and the asteroid collided in the Yucatan Peninsula, right on the seashore. So half of it was in the ocean, half of it was on the landmass. And geophysicists have actually gone to the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and have drilled down 1,000 feet and found the crater. The crater is 1,000 feet below the ground, which is why nobody has noticed it until fairly recently. In fact, the first indication of that crater was in Tennessee, because back in the early 1980s, they found this debris ridge. And what they realized is the debris ridge was part of a very large circle. And the debris ridge they found is what you would get from a really big asteroid collision. And so they decided to look at other parts of the circle, because they had enough of the ridge in Tennessee that they could figure out approximately where the rest of the circle should be. So they went down to southern Brazil and they found the other part of that circle. And then they were able to take the Brazilian piece and the Tennessee piece and figure out where the center of the big circle was. And they said approximately somewhere in the Yucatan Peninsula. Then they started digging around down there, found nothing. And then some guy got the bright idea, maybe it's buried underground. So he started drilling underground, 1,000 feet below the surface, they found it. Now, there's a little more detective work to it than that, because half the evidence of the collision event that it was marine, the other half of the evidence was that it was terrestrial. And so during the early 1990s, there was this huge debate. Did the asteroid fall in the ocean, or did it fall in the continental landmass? And one geophysicist said, well, maybe both sides are right. Maybe it fell right on the shoreline. And it was that piece of knowledge that enabled them to drill down 1,000 feet and actually find a thing. How big was it? It's about 180 kilometers across. That's the crater that was blown out by the initial condition. And then the debris ring has a 3,000-mile radius from the center of the collision. So you get this hole, then you get this debris ring that runs around it. So, yeah, it was a fairly big collision. Big enough that it would have put enough dust in the atmosphere of the Earth to block out the light of the sun for about 2 years. And that's what wiped out the dinosaurs. You block out the light of the sun for a couple of years, the plants that the dinosaurs are eating will die, and so the dinosaurs that are herbivores have nothing to eat, and the carnivores that feed the herbivores eventually have nothing to eat, and so they all go extinct. But, you know, what to me is really amazing is not so much that one, but the one that wiped out the Triassic dinosaurs, because there they have found 5 crater holes across southern Canada and northern United States, all in a nice line. In fact, they found a 6th crater hole on the same line in the Ukraine. And so you put that all together, and it's easily enough to wipe out the Triassic dinosaurs and all other large animal species. But in this case, they're able to document the replacement of the Triassic dinosaurs by the Jurassic dinosaurs. And in this case, they date that the window of time between the extinction and the speciation event is less than 10,000 years. And if it's less than 10,000 years, the Darwinists have no way to explain how you can get such large animals from such tiny bacteria that would have survived the event. The bacteria would have survived, a few insects would have survived, everything bigger than the insects would have been wiped out. And, you know, how do you evolve big dinosaurs from insect-sized creatures in less than 10,000 years? And incidentally, you run into the same thing with a Cretaceous event, because you see this immediate speciation of birds and mammals after the Cretaceous dinosaurs are wiped out, once again, 10,000 years or less. So we're going to get to that when we study Psalm 104, because Psalm 104 says it's the property of all life to die off. But God recreates. He replaces the species that naturally go extinct with new species of life that are better adapted for the changing environment. You say, why would God do this? Because you need different kinds of dinosaurs at different eras in the history of the Earth in order to deal with the changing conditions of the solar system. The sun is getting brighter and brighter. The wind velocity on the Earth is getting slower and slower. The continental movements are increasing. The continental landmass is increasing. The animals that are appropriate on the Earth 250 million years ago would not be appropriate for the Earth 100 million years ago. You need different species. And so God has this mechanism of removing the unsuitable species and replacing them with species that are suitable. So, at least up until human beings show up. We're at the end of the line. Okay. Now let me move into, I was going to give you a report on what happened in the Pacific Northwest, but I think I'll save that for next time because I want to have us spend some time here in the Book of Job. If I get some time into the class, I'll give you a quick report. But we've been looking at Job 38 again. Our first pass through Job 38 was to pick up the content that it gave us that reflected on the six creation days of Genesis chapter 1. With a theme that people who have are confused by what Genesis 1 says about the order of creation events and the details of the creation events, a lot of that confusion can be clarified by studying what Job 38 has to say about the six creation days. And if that doesn't remove all the confusion, then God has blessed us with Psalm 104 that also takes us through all six creation days. But we're going through this text again with the theme that the Lord is interrupting the debate of these five men. I refer them to the five scientists, Job and Elihu and Job's three friends. And the Lord finally interrupts the debate about creation and basically asks the five men 59 plus questions on creation and science. And as I mentioned, they were not able to answer any one of those questions. The entire set of questions that God posed to them were unanswerable to Job and his four friends. And then I asked you the question, how many of these questions can we answer today? I mean, here we have the advantage of 3,500 years plus of scientific research. How well are we doing today? And in my opinion, we can answer 9 of the 59 plus questions. Only 9. The other 50 we can't answer. Now, I think what's interesting is that each of these 9 questions that we can answer serves an important apologetic purpose. In other words, each one of the 9 questions we can answer, we today can use this as an argument for the truth of the Christian faith and the accuracy of the Bible as it speaks about science and therefore the accuracy that it has about all aspects that it deals with. But one of the things I wanted to lead off with today, the fact that we cannot answer the other 50 questions that the Lord poses to these five people in itself is an apologetic argument in this sense. If God didn't exist, if there was no God and the entire record of nature had a naturalistic explanation, then given the advance of science that we have achieved in the 21st century, we should be able to easily answer all 59 plus questions. The fact that there's only 9 questions that we can answer in itself, I would say, is a powerful argument that the Earth and its history and life on the Earth cannot have a naturalistic explanation. If it was that simple, we'd be able to answer all these questions. The fact that we can't answer these questions tells us it's not that simple. It's much more complex, and naturalistic explanations are inadequate. Yes. Right. That's true. In fact, there are parts of these 9 that we've only come to understand in the past year. Granted. Right. Now, what I meant by understanding is that here's the Lord asking a question. Can we give a reasonable answer to the question? Not that we give a complete answer. But, you know, here's, I mean, I look at this as the Lord subjecting these five men to the equivalent of a science test. Says, I got a bunch of questions for you. I'm going to grade you on this test and see how well you do. And so, you know, I'm kind of looking at it from the Lord's perspective. If I was the Lord grading their exam, would I give him a check or would I give him an X? And, you know, this is somewhat debatable in the sense that when you look at the nine questions, I would agree with you, none of them do we have a complete answer for. But, you know, taking my role as the divine professor, I'd say, well, it's a good enough answer, I'll give you a check. That's okay. And then there's others in the list of the 50 where I would say maybe we got 10% understanding of the phenomena that explains what's going on here. But since it's only 10%, you don't get a score on this question. But it does tell us that within maybe another 5 years, we may have 12 of these questions answered rather than just nine. And the fact that a year ago the list would have only been seven, I think is interesting. You know, we live in a day of great scientific advance, but that also is an argument. Given that we live in a day of great scientific advance, I think it's significant that generously we can only answer nine. If generously we can only answer nine, then that really calls into question the hypothesis that all we're looking at is natural history. It's just way too complicated. If it was simpler and really naturalistic, we should be performing a lot better than a grade of F minus on this quiz. So with that, let me jump into it. I think I got through the first one last week. I got nine here. I thought I could get through the whole thing. I got half an hour. We might be able to do it today. You know, the test starts off in verse 4 of chapter 38. So the first three verses are an introduction to the test, kind of like the Lord explaining to these five guys what the rules of the exam are. And then he jumps into the test in verse 4 and takes it right to the end of the chapter. You've got to get all the way down to verse 8 before there's a question that we can claim to have some kind of a decent answer for, and it's called, who can shut up the sea behind doors? And this is a theme that's picked up in Psalm 33, Proverbs 8, as well as Psalm 104. So it's a theme that God comes back to again and again, and it's a point that's made in Genesis chapter 1, creation day 3, where it talks about God taking this planet where there is water over the whole face of the earth, and then creating land masses to separate the waters so that we would have oceans and these continental land masses. This is what the text means in Psalm 33 and Job 38, Proverbs 8, and Psalm 104, when it talks about God shutting up the sea behind doors. In fact, Job 38 defines the doors as these land masses that God has put up to block the waves so that the waves can't go past that barrier. Now, I would argue that we have fairly decent understanding of how that came about. In fact, one of the books we have there at the table, I guess we don't have any books at the table right now, but we've had them there in the past, is a book called Rare Earth. And it's not written by Christians. It's written by an atheist and agnostic, an atheist paleontologist and an agnostic astronomer. And these two gentlemen devote probably half the book to this amazing miracle of planet Earth, that we have a planet with oceans and continents on it, and how that requires plate tectonics operating for billions of years, with life working with the plate tectonics to make sure those continental land masses get built up. Basically, what's taking place on planet Earth is that silicate is being built up above the basalt, and eventually the silicate gets above the surface of the waters, and then life and rain work together to erode that silicate and convert it into sand and carbonates and the life that dies, coal oil and the natural gas. This is all part of this complex process of maintaining these doors. So God set up these doors, these continental land masses. He'll tell us in Psalm 104 that once the doors are set up, the water can never again cover the face of the earth. Now, this is not in the book Rare Earth, but you know, we commented on Rare Earth on our Creation Update webcast. We made the point that one of the miracles that was not addressed by Ward and Brownlee in the book Rare Earth is how amazing it is that you can sustain continents for billions of years. And the continents have been here for about 3.25 billion years, but it takes exquisite fine-tuning to make sure that we have just the right erosion, just the right energy flow from the core of the Earth through radiometric decay, that we can maintain those continental land masses. Because even if you've got plate tectonics, my expectation is the continents would form, they would submerge, they would form, they would submerge. But the text tells us that once God sets it up, it's permanent. Yes. Well, Genesis 1 makes the point how God creates, doesn't use the word, but you can get it from the sense of the Hebrew, God forms these basins in which the water collects. Those would be the oceans. And then we have these kind of the land masses that pop up above the surface of the waters.
Not chambers,
yeah. Kind of think of it as a bowl that the water flows down into. And, you know, the basalt is denser than the silicate, so the silicate floats above it, so it does create these basins. But the amazing thing is that this is something that's permanent. Well, it's only really been in the last few years that geophysicists have been able to understand the mechanism of plate tectonics and the erosion forces on the Earth and how life contributes to those erosion forces, so they can understand how there's this rather rapid buildup of the continental land masses. And that's something you see in Genesis chapter 1. Third creation day, we have the appearance of these continental land masses. And I look at that as a prediction that this is something that happens rapidly. And then from that point onward, you've got a very slow growth of the continental land masses. That's something we're perceiving in the geological history, is that there was this buildup from about 1% to 3% of the surface of the Earth. Then it rapidly went from 3% to 21%, and that took place about 2 billion years ago, 2.2 billion years ago, and it's been very slowly growing from 21 to 22% to what it is today, 29%. In fact, the growth is getting slower and slower as time goes on. Rapid? Okay, in the space of a billion years, it goes from 3% to about 21 to 22%. Yeah, that's good. You know, astronomers have a different definition of rapid than other people do. I understand that. And it's been very slow since. The continents, by the way, are still growing, but at a much slower pace than they've ever grown in the past, simply because the Earth is rotating more and more slowly. So the slow rotation rate, erosion is less effective at wearing down the continental land masses. So, but yeah, the Hawaiians can be assured that their state's getting bigger and bigger. North Carolina is disappointed by the fact that their state's getting smaller and smaller as a result of erosion. It'll be a while before Hawaii catches up with North Carolina. But, you know, the fact that we can understand, yeah, go ahead.
Second Peter, verse 6.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 3, verse 6?
Yeah.
Right.
Whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished.
Right.
What does that mean, the world that then was?
Okay, the phrase there in the Greek is cosmos tote. And cosmos is our world, is our word for universe or world or nation. And then the word tote means at the time the event took place. And so Peter is making a distinction for the readers of his epistle between the world at the time of Noah and the world at the time of the Romans. So he says the world at the time the event took place, not our world, but their world, was flooded. And so the whole point is, how extensive was the world of Noah's generations? Well, if you go back into the book of Genesis, you discover there is no geographical place names outside of the Mesopotamian region until you get to the 10th chapter of Genesis. And therefore, I would use that as a strong implication that the human species had not yet made it past the regions of Mesopotamia until after the time of Noah's flood. And that would be a different world from the world of the Roman Empire. You know, it's what you also see in the New Testament is Paul referring to the Roman Christians. And he says in chapter 1 of the book of Romans, your faith has been heard throughout the whole world. Now, he wasn't meaning the Aborigines in Australia or the Incas in Peru. He was saying the your whole world, which would be the Roman Empire. That would have been the whole world for the citizens of Rome. Your faith has been heard throughout the whole Roman Empire. But here in 2 Peter, Peter's making a distinction between the world of the Roman Empire and the world of Noah. It's a different world. We know it's a different world because if it wasn't different, Peter would not have put that adjective in tote. So the fact that it's cosmos tote rather than simply cosmos tells us we're talking about a limited flood. Now, that's one of the proof texts we've used along with Psalm 104 and Job 38 and Proverbs 8, that the flood of Noah could not have covered the whole face of the earth. Can't cover the whole planet, because it tells us in Psalm 104, also here in Job 38, that once God sets up these doors, which is third creation day, the waters can never again cover the whole surface of the earth. Let me just give you the verse. It's here it is. It says, "You set a boundary they cannot cross," referring to these doors. Psalm 104, verse 9. "Never again will they cover the earth." So in the beginning, the waters covered the whole surface of the earth. But once God sets up the doors, that can't happen again. Therefore, that's probably the best place I would go to prove that the flood of Noah could not have covered the whole planet.
Was there ever a rainbow before the flood?
I believe there were rainbows before the flood. I mean, that's often an argument that's made, is that it didn't rain before the flood, because the first rainbow we see mentioned in the Bible is in Genesis chapter 9. But we need to look at the context. What God is saying about the rainbow in Genesis 9, he's saying to Noah, "See that rainbow? From now on, that rainbow will be a sign of a covenant agreement, a contract agreement I'm making with the human species." Well, one thing you can do as an exercise is go throughout the entire Bible and look up every covenant that God makes with the human species. And what you'll note is God signs every covenant with something familiar from the natural realm. So like with water baptism, the water is that signature sign for us. And so the rainbow would be something that Noah was already familiar with, and what God is saying, this rainbow that you've been seeing throughout your 600 years, from now on, that rainbow will be a sign that I will keep my promise I'm making with the human species, not to destroy the human species with a flood of water. And so the fact that it fits in with the other nine covenant agreements that God makes, where he uses something that they're already familiar with from the natural realm as a way to sign his agreement, tells us there were rainbows before the flood of Genesis 6, 7, and 8. Another proof text you can go is Genesis chapter 2, where it talks about how there was this Garden of Eden. And rain had not yet fallen, but it says instead God sent a mist. Well, I mean, most of you know you get a rainbow from a mist just as like you get a rainbow from rain. In fact, you tend to get a better rainbow from a mist than you do from falling raindrops. And by the way, the Hebrew word for mist, matar, as compared to the word ed for rain, simply means small liquid drops of water as opposed to large liquid drops of water. For a scientist, it spills drops of liquid water in the sky. In fact, what's interesting about those two Hebrew words is that when you see them in other Semitic languages, it depends on the region how big the drops of water are in the mist. Gleason and Archer has argued that word, when it's applied to the region of Babylon, is used for a fog, whereas in the region of Palestine, it's used for significant drops of water in the atmosphere. So it really depends on what kind of precipitation you're used to, how that definition goes. But either way, you get rainbows. So there's been rainbows there before. Okay, let's move on to the second thing I think we can understand. And by the way, I'm not giving you all the explanation for the doors that the sea is closed behind, because I think the book Rare Earth has done an excellent job of explaining, how that actually operates and how incredibly rare it is that Earth has these plate tectonics. That was their argument for saying that Earth must be the only place with advanced life, because it is just so incredible that we would have this long-lasting plate tectonics that would maintain this planet with the continents and oceans. And incidentally, this also helps us understand what Genesis 1 is saying. So it serves two apologetic values. In a sense, it helps us understand what Genesis 1 is saying on Creation Day 3. And also I'd make the point that of all the creation accounts, I was 10 years old when I read a book about all the creation myths of the world's beliefs and religions. There's over 150 of them. The Bible is the only